Is the resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota part of a spiritual awakening that will eventually overcome the current paradigm and lead to a transition away from extractive industries? Could non-governmental environmental organizations and their involvement in the Standing Rock resistance be jeopardizing meaningful stewardship of the land and the waters? Could the resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline as manifested at Standing Rock represent a template that could be used to pacify indigenous resistance across the continent? On this special edition of the Global Research News Hour, as the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers announces the final easement that will allow for the completion of the controversial Dakota Access Pipeline project, we get an overview of the resistance at the Standing Rock Sioux Nation protest camp and place it in the context of economic and physical factors. We'll hear from two longtime Indigenous participants in the camp, a scientist who has researched pipeline risks, and an independent investigative journalist who has chronicled the corrupting influence of foundation-funded environmental NGOs on environmental activism, with the Standing Rock resistance functioning as an important case study. On this week's program, Dapple Denouement. Has the Standing Rock resistance been co-opted by the nonprofit industrial complex? Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of February 10th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. The show is broadcast on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States, and is podcast on the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. An element in most of us cheers on Robin Hood and his band of thieves because they stole from the rich to give to the poor. But why do so many still support the Clinton family following almost two decades spent evidently stealing from the poor to reward themselves and their rich cronies and political supporters? From what I can tell, and from what determined readers and government authorities can discover, the network of Clinton tax-exempt entities practices charity in name only. It is false philanthropy about which examples must be made, with stiff punishments and financial restitution. The Clinton case must not stand unexposed or unpunished. That was an excerpt from an interview with Charles Ortel by Dadi Sherry under the headline, "Predatory Humanism and the Plunder of Haiti. Clinton, Robin Hood in Reverse, Must Be Punished." Posted February 9th, originally appearing at Haiti Sherry. On December 27, 2016, the Cuban National Assembly of People's Power held a debate on how to legislate the will of Fidel to reject any tendency toward the cult of personality. The law expressly bans the use of Fidel's name, quote, to denominate institutions, plazas, parks, streets, avenues, and other public places, as well as any type of decoration, recognition, or honorary title, unquote. Likewise, it is forbidden to use denominations or images of or allusions of any nature to his figure, quote, to erect monuments, busts, statues, commemorative strips, and other similar forms of homage, unquote, as well as to use it as a trademark or for other distinctive signs, domain name, and designs for commercial or advertising purposes, except when it comes to the use of his name to denominate any future institution that might be created according to the law to study his invaluable trajectory in the history of the nation. There were a variety of opinions expressed in the Parliament on how to honor Fidel's desire, as expressed to his brother Raul Castro. At the same time, deputies stressed the need to maintain, study, and propagate Fidel's legacy for the benefit of present and future generations not familiar with Cuba when the historic leader of the Cuban Revolution was still alive. However, the debate was largely censored by the U.S. corporate media. That comes from the article, Fidel Castro's Historical Legacy, Defiance of U.S. Imperialism, by Arnold August, posted February 9th. It seems that Nikki Haley, like millions of her fellow Americans, does not know the history of the Crimean people's struggle against its illegal annexation by Ukraine, which began in 1990 and ended in 2014. Questioning the choice of the Crimean people in 2014 seems to be the reason why the U.S. permanent representative to the UN Security Council is keeping quiet about the Ukrainian annexation of Crimea in the 1990s. After all, no one in the world could doubt the results of the Crimean referendum held on the 20th of January 1991. If it is a case of the deliberate distortion of facts, however, then the situation looks a lot worse. If you were to side with the Crimean people, then the history of Crimea's reunification with Russia becomes simple and understandable. That comes from the article, What America Should Know About Annexed Crimea, We the People of Crimea, by Arina Tsukhanova, posted February 9th, originally appearing at Oriental Review. Our scientists and academics, if they are mad enough and can summon their courage to boycott, could make a tremendous impact. Unexpectedly, tens of thousands have already signed on to what's become a tsunami wave to challenge Trump's Muslim ban. University staff, hospital administrators, researchers, and professors in all fields of scholarship and science are publicly acknowledging the millions of women and men in their labs, their lecture halls, their conferences and panels, and their classrooms who are recent or settled immigrants, visiting students, invited professors, co-authors, all foreign-born, many of them Muslim, on special visas or with green cards. In respect to President Trump's travel ban, two major academic boycotts are underway. A Canadian boycott with over 4,000 signatories arose on the heels of another initiated in the UK with over 42,000 supporters. All are refusing to attend any professional conferences in the USA. That comes from the article, Prejudiced President, Pliant Republican Party, Return of the Boycott as Political Resistance, by Barbara Nimri Aziz, posted February 9th. The Trump team has settled on a strategy of cat and mouse, which means they're trying to beat Iran by tricking them into making a mistake that will give the U.S. the advantage. In other words, Trump does not want a shooting war with Iran. He simply wants Iran's leaders to overreact to Washington's bullying by abandoning JCPOA. That's the goal. The fact that the administration can't unilaterally reject the nukes deal doesn't mean that Iran can't be duped into doing it for them. And if Iran takes the bait and withdraws from the agreement, then Trump will have the allies on his side for another painful round of economic sanctions. That comes from the article, Trump Plays Cat and Mouse with Iran, by Mike Whitney, posted February 9th, originally appearing at Counterpunch. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The Dakota Access Pipeline Project is a $3.8 billion initiative owned and directed by Houston-based Energy Transfer Partners and designed to transport roughly 500,000 barrels of crude a day from the Bakken oil field in North Dakota through a 1,172-mile-long underground pipeline running through four states to an oil tank farm near Patoka, Illinois. Several Indian tribes, particularly the Sioux and the Dakotas, have expressed opposition to the pipeline, arguing that it crosses sacred sites and that a breach would pose a threat to a river system providing drinking water for millions. As you will hear, traditional peoples decided to erect a spiritual camp at Standing Rock Sioux Reservation near the pipeline path. In early December, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, in what was described at the time as a victory, announced they would not grant an easement for the section of the pipeline to traverse Lake Oahe, and would seek an environmental impact statement exploring a reroute. This victory was short-lived, however, as newly elected President Donald Trump would sign an executive order calling for the advancement and expedition of the pipeline. While numbers have greatly diminished. There are a number of water protectors, indigenous and non-indigenous, that have remained in place, intent on continuing to block construction of the Black Snake, as it is referred to in prophecy. As of early February, the remaining campers are in the process of relocating the camp. Despite the presence of an exuberant oil extractive administration in Washington, the spirit of resistance has yet to be completely snuffed out. Two individuals who had been active with the camp for an extended period of time did agree to speak with us. In the segment that follows, you will hear their impressions of the camp, the challenges it faced, and the overall sense they convey of the camp's significance.
Ah, bonjour, Kishkandokekwe, Ndishna Kazmakwa, Nidodem. My name is Cedar Woman. I'm of the Bear Clan. I come from Anishinaabe territory, so-called Winnipeg, Manitoba. You asked what got me involved with Standing Rock. Ancestors, creator, spirit. It's something that's deep within me that takes me to the front lines and to the people that I engage with in my walk to protect the water, the land, for our future generations and those yet to come. I think what truly brought me to Standing Rock was when I met Joy Braun at a summit in Pennsylvania, and her call for support when the call out came for Standing Rock Sioux Tribe at the Cannonball River against Dakota Access Pipeline. I did a visit, a quick one in April, just to see what was going on, came back and shared that information, and then returned after spending some time with some community protectors and some spiritual people, asking for that guidance, whether it was the right thing to go down and participate.
Chantewash Day, Yuhan, Apeche Yuzapi. Good afternoon, relatives. I shake your hand with a warm heart. And my English name is Paula Antoine, and my Lakota name is Wopilamli, which means woman who gives thanks. And I'm an enrolled member of the Sichangu Lakota Band of the Lakota Nation, who is part of the Osheti Shakoi, the seven council players. And that's in Rosebud, South Dakota. And currently I'm the I'm part of an organization. I'm part of a tribe, and the tribal council recognized me as one of four council appointed organizers for our spiritual camp. And how that came to be, it is over the since 2008, my tribe has been opposing the KXL pipeline, and we started a spiritual camp. There were a lot of legislation that our tribe did to try to stop the pipeline, but as it was coming closer, we decided to take another step, and we decided and met with a couple dozen people, and we decided that we were going to do a spiritual camp on our land.
I can't say enough about the people that organized there. I mean, just the thousands of people that were arriving daily, the needs that were being met daily, the support that was coming in minute by minute, it brought the world together. That is truly what humanity is all about, is what happened at Osheti, Sacred Stone, Rosebud, and it's still happening right now with that big move that is happening, you know, out of Osheti and the floodplains. You know, those people, our relatives, our family members, our sisters, our brothers, our grandmothers, our grandfathers, they're still there. They're still a community. They're still working together. They're not leaving. They're still standing their ground. And I think it's important that people understand that this is never going to end, whether it be Dakota Access, whether it be any pipeline, Line 3, TransCanada, Kinder Morgan, XL. There are so many pipelines, and I think Standing Rock, Sacred Stone Camp, Rosebud, Ochetee, and all the new camps that are forming now. This is unity. This is what it's going to take for those so-called governments to see that the people are standing together and saying no. We're organized. We've come together in ceremony with big hearts, big love. We want to see our future generations have what is here now, not less. They deserve better and more.
The access point was up the road, and every day a different tribe would lead a prayer walk. And so everyone would follow the leader tribe to go up, you know, and it changed every day, to go up to the access point, and that individual tribe would say their prayers in their languages and have their leader pray in their way, and everybody would go up and support them and pray with them. And so, you know, that's not a direct action. That is a prayer. I know that the company asked the tribe to produce documentation on and proof of sacred sites in the area. And I know that they did. And within 8 hours, the company was bulldozing that area. And it just so happened they were bulldozing right when the prayer walk was taking place. And so people went up to the fence line to where that was happening. And I chose not to go. So, but that day, you know, several people that I know went up there, and there was a confrontation, and dogs were used to attack our people. And people were injured and bit. And at that point, we did not know what, you know, how it would escalate to the situation it is now. You know, we have people that there's been, you know, psychological warfare occurring since that day. You know, the people that are in the camp can hear the planes and the helicopters going overhead 24 hours a day sometimes. They're not flying now, but they had been. And to have the number of lights that are in the area constantly on the horizon, and knowing each day when they put up new lights that they were possibly digging up and destroying sacred sites or burial grounds or something culturally significant to our tribes. And every day they would turn on another light and get closer to the river. And to see Humvees and military-style vehicles up there. There was one up there that was, I'm not sure what the term is for that vehicle, but it fires missiles. And that was one of the vehicles, military-style vehicles that was parked on the hill daily above the camp.
I came with the grandmothers, with the elders, with the ceremonial people, and really didn't participate in the nonviolent direct actions per se, front line where our relatives were being maced and tear gassed and shot with rubber bullets and handled in atrocious ways. All I could do in those times was continue to be in ceremony with the elders and the grandmothers. And pray and pray for their protection. You know, they thought Manitoba was or Winnipeg was the racist capital. I beg to differ. It was very stressful and at times very disheartening to even think of leaving camp to go shopping. You were afraid. You didn't know if you would even make it into town to shop, because you were being followed by, you know, North Dakota trooper or sheriff, and you were terrified that if you went over by 1 mile that you would be pulled over, and you never knew what could happen. So you always had your phones charged, and you were afraid.
From the beginning, the local press has tried to label the people that are in the camps as being violent. You know, they overplayed, you know, they, at some points during our prayer walks, they were, it was labeled to be a riot. And everything that we did was, had a negative spin on it in the media. And they did not understand our ceremonial songs. They did not understand the songs that we were singing. And there are points, I remember one time where we were singing a honor song. And in that honor song, there are times when the people, Akisha, and I'm not sure if you know what that means, but that means they acknowledge with their voice the person who's being honored. So during the points of the song, when it was appropriate to Akisha, then the people would Akisha. And there was always Martin County officials on their loudspeaker, and it just shocked me. And he said, "Please do not fight amongst each other." And I was like, "What? We are not," you know, he just did not understand that we were acknowledging an honor song and someone's name. And he assumed from his own cultural beliefs that we were yelling at each other.
The non-governmental organizations like the Sierra Club and 350.org and Rainforest Action Network, I mean, did you find them to be altogether responsible and respectful allies, or were they intrusive in some way?
I know that the indigenous-led organizations are the ones that are still here right now. Mm. While there are nobody else is here. And we're the ones that are working on cleanup and ensuring that the land that we did camp on is left better than when we came. So I really don't have too much enough experience with the Big Greens that did come in, that my interaction with them was pretty minimal.
NGOs, we know that they write big proposals to get monies to do the things that they do. NGOs, to me, are a lot different than grassroots people. I consider myself more of a grassroots spiritual person. I don't think that Sacred Stone, Ochetti, and Rosebud would have come to fruition without those NGOs. But at the same time, the NGOs, when the sacred fire went out, they took their stand and they listened to those that put that first sacred fire out at Ochetti, and they did what they thought was the right thing to do. NGOs, grassroots people, we're all family, we're all related, and we're all working together. And if we don't continue to work together, we're never going to beat these big government people and their pipelines and their fracking and their logging and their mining and. I mean, it comes down to, again, the water. We need to be mindful about the water and continue to pray for the water. Without water, they have nothing.
This is a quote from the Red Warrior Camp's communique, December 2016. It says, "Standing Rock Sioux Tribe's chairman, Dave Archambault, has made it abundantly clear that a diversity of tactics in the battle against the Dakota Access Pipeline is not respected nor wanted. We have this to say. Without the courage and the actions of those who actually put their minds, bodies, and spirits in harm's way, the pipeline would be built. Without the warriors who locked down and took measures to put a stop to the work on DAPL, the black blood would already be flowing under the Missouri River. The peace policing was led by people who were for the most part self-appointed, used ceremony and spirituality as a weapon against us. They too have made it abundantly clear by their actions and their constant slinging of arrows that they are not ready to embrace a worldview that upholds decolonization and revolution. And then it goes on to say, this fight is not over yet. Energy transfer partners will push this pipe through unless there is a diversity of tactics that include direct action, and no court ruling or legal maneuvering will prevent that from happening alone. And Standing Rock Sioux Tribe is heavily engaged in praying away a pipeline without action. This is in direct opposition to who we are as warriors. So I mindful of the fact that there, I mean, it does seem like a criticism of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. I'm wondering what your thoughts are as you listen to those words, especially in the context of what you might call divide and conquer tactics. Fair comment?
It's not about conquer and divide. I think there's more to all of this than we know. We're not sitting at those big tables with Dave. We're not sitting at those big tables with LaDonna. We're not sitting in those courtrooms. We're not that judge. We're not those lawyers. We're not those people that were arrested. So, again, from one quote from Red Warrior Camp to someone else's personal quote, to someone else's personal quote, to someone else's personal quote, we all have our own opinions. And I think most importantly is that we all were there. We all brought our gifts, or some of us are still there. Some of them are still there. And they're still carrying those gifts in the best way they know how and participating. And I think at the end of the day, participation, no matter what it looks like, as long as we're participating and standing against the oppressor, then that's all that truly matters. It's about the unity. It's about bringing our gifts and standing strong, no matter what that looks like. I honor those Red Warriors. I honor all those people that carry those gifts to those front lines. How can we not? Those are their gifts. We have to love them as much as I love you. I love them. No harm. We can only love. Because if we anger and we talk ill of each other, that just divides us. It just separates us. And then the gossip. Then the lateral violence. And then we're angry. And then we're fighting. And then we're separating. And then you're going there and I'm going here. And we're not organizing together anymore. So now we've lost another few people, a few more people, and a few more people, and then we're all separated again. No, we can't have that. We need to stay conducive to that unity piece.
As of today, the Corps of the Army Corps of Engineers has approved the easement to go underneath the Lake Oahe, the Missouri River, to drill under. And it's my understanding that my tribe and a couple others have filed temporary restraining orders on that easement. And I am pretty sure that the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, Ogallala Sioux Tribe, and the Sechungu Sioux Tribe have filed some form of document or some form of legal proceedings to stop that. And I think that one of the first ones will be heard on Monday. And then there are people that, you know, are continuing to clean up, and then there are people who are not going to leave. And they obtained a lease on a private property, and they're there, from what I understand. I haven't went to that location, but that's my understanding.
If you are going and you find that you are in need of something, make sure when you go that you have made arrangements, just in case you get arrested and you haven't connected with the lawyers, that you have a lawyer, that you have a number, that you have bail money. Again, self-sufficient.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Denis Lenevoux is a retired scientist with Atomic Energy of Canada. He's researched pipelines and the oil extraction method known as fracking, assessing them for their risks to the environment. Here's what he had to say about the Dakota Access Pipeline and the source of the crude it would transport.
Well, the Bakken oil has what they call a high gas-to-oil ratio. It's usually a lighter oil, and it has a lot of solution gas in it that's normally removed before transport. A lot of it is actually flared. And because it's a lighter oil, this makes it more explosive than a heavy oil. So that's a risk in transportation. It tends to volatilize more as well, so you would probably get more fumes from it from a spill. And it can contain hydrogen sulfide, which is a lethal toxic gas. And in fact, there was an incident a few years ago where Enbridge found over 1,000 parts per million of hydrogen sulfide in the storage tank that was going to lead into their pipeline, and they asked the regulatory permission not to carry it. But it's kind of a hit and miss thing in the Bakken. I think most of the oil there is what they call sweet, which doesn't contain much sulfur or hydrogen sulfide, but there are pockets that do.
You discovered through your research that the path of the DAPL would coincide with the Northern Border Natural Gas Pipeline, which was laid down in 1982. Just how big a risk could the proximity of the two pipelines pose residents in the vicinity?
Well, it's when the two get to close enough together, then the oil line becomes within the blast damage zone of the natural gas line. And you can get what is called a domino effect. So if the oil line explodes, it can rupture and ignite the oil line next to it. And that's the same oil that caused 47 deaths at Lac Megantic when it exploded and burned. So that's it's a low probability, high consequence event. And of course, it depends on where it occurs. If there's nobody around, it's not going to hurt anybody. But it's a possibility.
Well, do you have any insights into why state and federal authorities would agree to this right of way for the DAPL? Even if there is that threat, however, you know. Remote.
Well, from the maps, the one only map I saw, the distance apart is fairly large until it gets to Lake Oaha, and I'm not quite sure how to pronounce it, where it crosses, and they're quite close together. And there are advantages to following the same right-of-way. You don't have to appropriate any more land, and the permissions are already there, and so in that way there's less disruption of the for digging up the trench and so on. In terms of the pipeline company, it's probably a path of least resistance.
Could you talk about that issue of bank stability and the riverbed erosion and the threats along the Missouri River? How big a threat would that pose?
Well, there are several reports about that from the Army Corps of Engineers, and there's a series of dams that were built there around 1958 or so. Their reports say that increased the risk of erosion and bank instability, you get shifting deposition of sandbars, and you can get what they call river scour. So those dams apparently increase that risk. Risk for a pipeline, if you have a bank instability problem, it can put pressure on the pipeline and burst it. And in fact, that's what happened in the North Saskatchewan spill and quite a few other spills as well. So bank stability issue is a real issue for pipelines. Also in 2011, there was a major flood on the Missouri River, which can increase this bank instability, and it can lead to what is called river scour, where you're changing the course of the riverbed, and that can put pressure on the pipe. And these are sort of creeping events where it gradually causes slope movement that puts pressure on the pipe, and the movement accumulates in time, and it's often a trigger event, like a big rainfall, that can set it off, but it's been accumulating this problem over a long period of time. So these historic events like floods and so on, and bank erosion that has gone over many years, can lead to problems further down the line. So those problems are known to exist along that stretch of the Missouri River, which increases the risk of a spill right at the river, which is the last place you want it. You don't want it to spill into water supplies. And once it gets in the river, of course, it's carried rapidly downstream. And again, we've seen the effects of that on the North Saskatchewan spill.
Dennis Lenevu is a retired biophysicist formerly employed by Atomic Energy of Canada. He's researched and written extensively on the risks posed by hydraulic fracturing and oil and gas pipelines. He joined us from Selkirk, Manitoba. Early December, WrongKindOfGreen.org started to release a six-part series on the Dakota Access Pipeline resistance. The report provided a detailed look at the non-governmental organizations financed by philanthropic foundations which had ensconced themselves into the Indigenous-led resistance. The thesis of the series was that the non-profit industrial complex were not only helping to increase profits for its rich benefactors, but restricting the possibility of movements to address the urgent actions necessary to confront the clear and present threats to our ecosystem. The resulting dynamic would fit nicely into what Global Research founder and director Professor Michelle Chosadovsky refers to as the manufacture of dissent. The Global Research NewsHour had a chance to contact one of the series' authors, Corey Morningstar. She is an investigative journalist and longtime environmental activist, a critic of what she calls the nonprofit industrial complex, and a past guest of this program. I'm wondering if you just kind of give us a bit of a quick overview of how that financing from, say, you know, Rockefeller Foundation or Novo Foundation or whoever, how that serves to on the short term and the long term to distort the interests of the genuine environmental activism?
Well, the bulk of the movements that we have today, and I'll put movements in quotes, are basically managed, molded, shaped, essentially controlled by the nonprofit industrial complex, which is basically the profits from capital, from the global capitalist economic system that are funneled through all kinds of reasons, one of them being, tax evasion. So they're basically laundered through foundations set up by the elites and the corporations who create these foundations. And then from the foundations, they're again funneled into NGOs, sort of, you know, chosen in NGOs that work with the larger elites, oligarchs, what have you. And so, I mean, what we have, we end up having, you know, what I referred to today, just earlier this morning, is you could call it corporate activism. And the problem with corporate activism, long-term especially, is that it serves corporate interests, first and foremost, and always. In the case of these two pipelines, it's more about the protecting, I would say, a key part of this is protecting Warren Buffett's profits via Berkshire Hathaway and BNSF Rail. I mean, Keystone, the Dakota Access Pipeline is very similar to Keystone, but it has the indigenous patina, and you know, right over top of it, which really, really protects from any kind of dissent. So after I wrote the six-part series, I sort of see it as a template. I mean, 350.org actually has referred to it as a template for global actions in the future. And I think what's going to happen is that you're going to see a lot of the NGOs within the nonprofit industrial complex actually partnering, co-opting, exploiting indigenous groups to serve their own purposes. And in this case, we've seen, like, since the whole Keystone XL pipeline campaign started, you've seen Warren Buffett create a massive rail dynasty, you know, from nothing. And that all happened while everyone was focused on one single pipeline. And if you look at a map of pipelines, you can barely see the map. They just crisscross all over North America. So why one particular pipeline? But again and again, and you can see a new article published by Pamela Williams this week on Wrong Kind of Green on just the astronomical profits that have gone into Warren Buffett's empire. You know, Warren Buffett has contributed over $30 million into the Tides Foundation, which has doled out all the money for the anti-pipeline campaigns. So it's a lot of it is you know, exactly that. Even the what Pamela talks about is how they've created this campaign fairly new, I think, to the Dakota Pipeline campaign, which is divesting from banks. But as Pamela points out, the massive amount of money where the divestment should be targeting is Berkshire Hathaway stocks, shares, companies, corporations. And no matter where you look, whether it's at the NGOs or whether it's at the New York Times media, everyone absolutely avoids looking at BNSF, who actually now owns a fair portion of, what is it, Phillips 66, which is the corporation behind the Dakota Access Pipeline. So Buffett wins on all counts. Like, he wins keeping right now the especially with the huge oil glut. He really needs the oil, you know, continuing to move via rail to keep those profits, those profit margins intact. But on the other hand, he also wins when this pipeline goes through. I mean, we just have more of everything. We have more pipelines. We have more, obviously, massive amounts of, you know, massive volumes of crude going via rail. So we just have ended up with more and more and more of everything, you know, actually breaking oil production record, like making records, breaking records in oil production right up until the most recent oil glut, you know, and the only thing that sort of saved us for now is just that the world is awash in oil.
That economic aspect, that has more to do with keeping it in the ground, so to speak, than, you know, stopping a pipeline and divestment campaigns.
Yeah, and then, I mean, I follow a lot of Native people who have been on the ground at the camps, you know, who are really, really concerned about that. And a lot of them feel that because of the NGO involvement from the beginning, I mean, even the lawyers, and this is, you know, when you're dealing with tribal law and everything else, usually you're represented by Native attorneys because it's very, very specialized and they have their best interests on heart. But I mean, in this case, you've had Earth Justice lawyers from the going way back when the NGO sort of hopped on board to get involved. You know, they really, really begin to push the boundaries, you know, bringing in trainers. You've got people complaining and feeling like they have been shamed to remove their masks off their face, which is a big part of warrior culture. You've got NGOs basically trying to pacify resistance and tame a warrior culture. So you've got them all over the place. You've got them dealing with the lawyers. You've got them creating the websites. You've got them training, you know, a warrior culture to be passive in the face of violence. I mean, it's just really, really bad on many, many, many levels.
You'd think that the people on the ground would be getting informed by the people with that knowledge rather than these, you know, people, I think you mentioned like the celebrity Mark Ruffalo effectively lecturing them about, you know, how to conduct a proper strategy. And that seems kind of disrespectful.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I sort of surmised the whole thing as continued patriarchy and imperialism repackaged as matriarchal self-reliance. Like, I mean, there's so many aspects, and that's why I had to do a series and break it down into parts, because another huge component is the whole consumer activism component, which is a huge, huge thing right now. And you've got Neova's sister organization, Purpose, which is a behavioral change specialist, a PR firm in New York City that specializes in behavioral change. And they were behind the last climate march with Tick, Tick, Tick. I mean, they work with, you know, big business, Unilever, and the whole bit. So you've got Unilever, who owns Ben & Jerry's. So you've got Ben & Jerry's partnering with Standing Rock, and Unilever owns Ben & Jerry's. And, you know, they have, like, the most disgusting products, like a product called Fair & Lovely. It's a bleaching cream for women's skin that makes you go whiter, right? And so they're partnered with an indigenous resistance campaign, and they sell products that basically, you know, they're racist.
It capitalizes on the shaming people of color.
Exactly. And so that's, you know, just one partner. And then you've got them partnered with We Mean Business, which is Ceres, which is a divestment partner. Like, we're talking, Ceres works with all the biggest corporations on the planet. And you've got We Mean Business, which is Ceres, partnered with the B-Team, which is Richard Branson, which is Virgin Airlines, partnered with Purpose, which is Avaaz. I mean, this is what we call, refer to as networked hegemony. And this is really, really critical and really, really important, because right now we're just, and I don't even really know why, we've been engineered to trust these organizations, but we're literally going in blind, not even know, you know, who our actions are serving. And so you've got, for instance, I came across this one huge petition, and I'm not sure how many names they ended up getting, probably between 500,000 or 1,000,000, maybe more, but I noticed an NGO called Other 98. Was partnered with Standing Rock, and I was like, who's Other 98? Never even heard of it. And so Other 98 is basically an offshoot of an agency or an NGO called Agitpop. The co-founder of Other 98 and Agitpop is Andrew Boyd. And then when you follow that pathway, Andrew Boyd has an NGO, a nonprofit called Beautiful Trouble. And Beautiful Trouble works with all the big groups that are really on this nonviolent direct action bandwagon. It's like a dogma. I mean, it's just, you know, you're just beat on the head with it. Nonviolent direct action, nonviolent direct action. Now, if you look at the other co-founder of Agitpop, another 98, is John Sellers, who's the executive director of Ruckus. He's also very, very involved in Standing Rock. Now, I'm just going to jump back a bit here. The thing is, when you fill in this petition, who's getting your information? Like, this is the whole key to everything. I mean, the Trump was for the liberal left, like winning the lottery. Not only did they rake in millions upon millions, perhaps billions of dollars, you know, from a really, all of a sudden, really, I don't know, freaked out liberal left populace in the States. But a huge component of all of this is metrics and collecting of data that you share with your partners like Unilever for the purpose of consumer activism and just consumerism in general. And so basically, Other 98, if you follow that, they go back. They have a deep, deep relationship with Avaz. And again, Avaz, co-founder of Tick, 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 involved in the climate march, very involved in the crimes, basically crimes against the Libyan people, the Syrian people, very complicit in those, horrible, horrible invasions on sovereign states that killed tons and tons of people, that just created havoc, destroyed whole nations. So Avaz, one of their co-founders, is Democrat. Well, he's running again. He's sort of bounces all through the nonprofit industrial complex and the White House. But he's, Tom Perriello is co-founder of Avaz. So again, you see this interconnectedness, this revolving door between White House. On the chairman of Standing Rock, his sister, it works in the Obama administration, like, until recently. And now she's gone off to a law firm. She was there from 2008 till 2015, I believe. And so you have all, like, this massive network hegemony revolving door happening. And I mean, it just goes on and on. Then if you look at Beautiful Trouble, they're expanding across the globe. You can find Avaz in Africa, you know, Maasai people holding up posters that say Avaz. You know, I'm sure they've never even heard of it. You can see Burundi, which has been targeted, another country targeted for destabilization and regime change, but, led by the U.S. And you can see 350 in Burundi, again, with people. I mean, they're everywhere. It's amazing. I mean, it's actually amazing. The funding, the scope, it's the ultimate soft power.
Yes. I'm wondering what all of this means, because we've got, there's been this sea change with the new presidency, because you had all of these maneuvers, this sort of soft power manipulation of the environmental movement happening under the Obama administration, those, you know, ties with the Democratic Party, with, you know, 350.org and all the rest of it. And now you've got the Trump administration in power, and they seem to be more obviously hostile to the environmental movement. And so I'm wondering how you see all of this playing out, especially with the specific example of Standing Rock and an indigenous resistance. Does this reinforce or does this complicate this particular imperial tool?
I mean, that's a really good question. And I mean, Trump is such a wild card, you know, and I think it really, really threw the liberal left. I mean, you could see all of a sudden, you know, everyone was, especially in the U.S., was up in arms over, you know, him winning the election. And before, they basically worked hand in hand. They had a seat at the table. You know, they were part of the elite structure. And all of a sudden, they're just cast aside. I mean, I doubt Trump could give, you know, could care less about NGOs. He probably had never even heard about, you know, he probably doesn't even know who Bill McKibben is. Like, he works in a different way. Trump doesn't care about soft power. He's in-your-face hard power. So it'll be really, really interesting. And I'm, you know, I'm not sure what will happen with Standing Rock because they're asking people to leave. You know, people on the ground are unhappy. A lot of them feel sort of abandoned and, I don't know, disappointed. I don't want to speak for other people, but, yeah, I don't know. It's just really up in the air, I think. Actually really call myself an activist anymore because I'm not even sure what that means in this day and age. You've got a major, major shift from actually environmentalism to anthropocentrism, which instead of actually working to protect nature, you work to protect human life, and not even human life, human Anglo life, you know, a tiny pocket of people that basically sharing all the privileges of, you know, the privileges coming from, that come from destroying and plundering a planet, if that even makes any sense. And so, yeah, I mean, you've just got people, even in the last part of the series, I tried to demonstrate that through showing how the, I think they're called the Bishnois of India.
Yes, I saw that.
Yeah, and just how they actually died protecting, you know, attempting to protect the trees because that was so important to them. And now, even if you look at campaigns, at logos, at basically the aesthetics of modern day, you know, activism, quote unquote, all you see is windmills, right? Solar panels. Technology. I mean, you're not even seeing. Nature is like not, if it's even in the image, you might see maybe a cloud somewhere in the background. I mean, we're actually replacing environmentalism with anthropocentrism. And it's happening so, it's so sophisticated that we don't even notice.
Well, Corey Morningstar, I think we are going to leave it there. So, but I do appreciate your writing and your occasional appearances on the program. Thank you so much for your thoughts.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
We've been speaking with Corey Morningstar, investigative journalist and researcher. She is the author with Forrest Palmer of a series called Standing Rock, Profusion, Collusion, and Big Money Profits. And you can find that on the website wrongkindofgreen.org as well as on her personal website, theartofannihilation.com. That concludes this special program dedicated to the Dakota Access Pipeline resistance at Standing Rock Sioux Nation. People wishing to inform themselves further may wish to visit standwithstandingrock.net, nodaplsolidarity.org, or follow the hashtag nodapl. Critical commentary on the involvement of non-governmental organizations in the pipeline fight, including Corey Morningstar's six-part series and the February 8th article Buffett, Gates Foundation, Bono's Red, and the Dakota Access Pipeline by Pamela Williams, can be found on the website wrongkindofgreen.org. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. Our show airs weekly on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm and our podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. On February 17th at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, the Global Research News Hour will broadcast a live show to raise funds for host station CKUW. The show will feature special guest Abby Martin, host of the Empire Files for Telesur and former host of RT's Breaking the Set. We will be discussing the importance of supporting independent media in the current political landscape and hoping to raise funds for the station in the meantime. If you would like to donate to the Global Research News Hour, please send your contribution to fundrive.ckuw.ca or phone during the show. We air locally at 95.9 FM. And stream on the page ckuw.ca/listen. I am series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Bye for now.